Support for this program is provided by Chevron, the human energy company.
This is Politico Energy. I'm Annie Snyder. The United States is at a critical juncture when it comes to clean, safe, and affordable water. Right now, the Biden administration is churning out strict new regulations aimed at limiting toxic contaminants in drinking water. Climate change is shrinking supplies in the West, and aging systems are facing expensive upgrades just to keep functioning. But don't just take my word for it.
I think this is a hugely pivotal moment in the history of water in the United States, right? Not just California, not just the Western region. Where it really meets the road for most families is that water bill that comes in at the end of the month.
That's Senator Alex Padilla, the California Democrat who is the Senate's leading voice on water issues. I recently sat down with him to talk about what it will take to ensure that Americans have water at their taps that's safe to drink and doesn't bust their budgets. Here's my extended interview with Senator Padilla. It's Monday, April 22nd. Well, Senator Padilla, thank you for joining us for the Politico Energy podcast today.
Well, thank you for having me. Lots to talk about.
Indeed. So the water sector is contending with a lot right now. You've got big new regulations out of the Biden administration, water scarcity challenges across the West, and just the expense of operating aging systems around the country. Is it going to be possible to face all of this and keep water affordable?
Failure is not an option. I mean, what can be more fundamental to an individual's needs, to a family's needs, to our economy's needs than a reliable source of clean, safe, and affordable drinking water, water to drink, water for sanitation, water for so many of what we rely on it for. So I'm thrilled to be here at this key moment in time for our country, bringing to bear, you know, my experience as a policymaker at the local level, where once upon a time I served on the city council in Los Angeles, served once upon a time in the California legislature, getting the appreciation of a statewide look at all the same challenges and bringing those experiences to bear here at the national level.
When you talk to big water utility heads, I think most will acknowledge that water rates are going to need to go up. But at the same time, they know that many of their customers can't afford their bills as they stand now. During the pandemic, Congress approved a program to provide assistance for water bills to low-income families, but I think that program expired at the end of last month. I know you have a bill that would make it permanent. Do you see a path forward for that?
I do. I mean, I know bipartisan support is sometimes hard to come by in Congress, but I am hopeful, number one, because of the sheer need that exists throughout the country. Blue states, red states, you know, access to clean, safe drinking water is not a partisan issue. A lot of it does come down to how do we pay for it? We being government, we being water utilities and agencies, we being families at all income levels. And I'm hopeful because the initial sort of pilot program was approved on a bipartisan basis. So there's a track record, there's a vote history we can remind our colleagues of, and we point to the success of the many, many, many families that benefited from that relief, benefited from that assistance. And I'm also hopeful because I know it's proven to be so successful for many years on the energy side. A lot of lower income, working class families are familiar with the LIHEAP program, Low Income Household Energy Assistance Program, for the same reason that we shouldn't let people freeze in the winter just because they happen to be low income. You know, we should help families keep water running in their taps.
You mentioned bipartisan support. I know there was a letter recently on this program, and I think it was all Democrats signed on. Do you have any Republicans committed at this point?
We're still working on those. You know, from one Congress to the next, things can change. And we have the politics of a presidential election year. So when in some quarters we're hearing cuts, 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 maybe it's not quite ripe today, but I do believe in the near future, the political climate will allow Republicans to publicly come on board. I know in private conversations, people understand, people will get it.
So the political path forward on your bill, it sounds like it's not imminent. I mean, the election is months away still. The program has expired. How dire is the situation now? I mean, are we looking at a scenario where we're going to start seeing wave of shutoff notices?
Well, I certainly hope not. You know, working with all stakeholders to try to continue to provide the temporary relief and accommodation for families who may be in the toughest of situations and scenarios. The breakthrough may not come today or this week, but I do think it's going to be in the near future for all the reasons that I've articulated. More than anything, the temporary program that was put in place at the beginning of the COVID pandemic proved to be so successful. So the successes are there. The benefits are unquestionable. And this really laid the foundation for us to be able to do it next. You know, the next series of appropriations bills, for example, won't be till the end of the fiscal year, you know, later in September, or maybe towards the end of the calendar year, because we always give ourselves extensions on that. Or maybe we can have the bill we've introduced go alone or as part of a larger package. We're constantly looking for that next opportunity to get this closer to the finish line.
As you mentioned, one of the things sort of driving potential water rate increases is big new regulations coming online. One of the things that can often be hard to talk about in the drinking water space is the sort of tension between cost and benefit, especially as science allows us to measure contaminants at lower and lower levels and understand the health effect that they have. I think the PFAS regulation that the Biden administration just recently put out kind of exemplifies this. It has stringent standards, setting a limit for PFAS at very, very low levels. And the agency itself acknowledges that that's going to cost $1.5 billion every year for the foreseeable future. That cost and stringency is already getting some pushback, including from some of the Republicans who pushed EPA to do a drinking water regulation in the first place. And so I'm wondering if you think that this approach, this really stringent approach to the Biden administration, is one that's going to be workable and doable in the long run.
I do believe so, because if you sort of take it step by step, right, start with the premise of, does everybody deserve safe drinking water? The answer is yes. And thanks to science, we are able to identify more contaminants and at what levels they pose higher risks for individuals, young and old, right? Because there's a whole other discussion about thresholds for adults versus thresholds for children. We know that we need to do a better job of treating PFAS where we find it or keeping PFAS from entering into the drinking water supply. That's not really the question. Everybody would agree that on that. The question is then, how do we achieve that? And we get back to this sort of cost question. How much can individual ratepayers, aka families, truly absorb individually? What utilities can absorb, and what the role and responsibility is of the federal government to participate in that? So I think back to the beginning of your question, this is sort of an exhibit A on the fundamental dynamics of all this.
The other big dynamic at play around PFAS is the question of a Superfund regulation. I think many people see that as important for being able to hold polluters accountable and make sure that there is funding available to, as you say, stop some of the stuff earlier on in the process. But water utilities are, of course, worried that they could end up getting pulled into litigation as a result of that as well. Would you support a legislative exemption for water utilities?
We're certainly hearing that from a lot of the water utilities in California and beyond. Yes, want to work with them to make sure that the responsibility falls on the shoulders of the polluters, those responsible for the contamination in the first place. That's got to be the North Star here.
But would you legislate an exemption there?
If necessary, I think we're still working with the administration on an administrative way to achieve that. Water utilities want to be partners in all this because they know their role in not just intake of water, water treatment, and then delivery of water to businesses and households. But we can't let polluters off the hook. We've seen that happen time and time again throughout our nation's history, not just on water, but including water and elsewhere.
So another one of the huge challenges facing the water sector right now is water scarcity and climate change driven drought, especially in the West.
California's Exhibit A.
Exhibit A. Along the Colorado River, many water managers are now talking about augmentation being necessary through things like desalination to bring additional supplies to the region. But obviously, that's hugely expensive as well.
And energy intensive, which has its own set of issues.
Yeah. So are you starting to strategize about how you could bring federal funding to bear in a big way towards some of these Western water scarcity challenges?
Absolutely. And I think we can actually make a lot of progress in the near term, just through the sharing of best practices, including the tough decisions that we made 20 years ago to address water shortages in California. Colorado River is significant. 40 million people rely on the Colorado River for their drinking water. Half of them live in California. And with our changing climate, that's our reality. That's not really a debate. The science is clear. The evidence is clear. We have to be able to do more with less. Kids who learn about recycling in third grade nowadays, right? Reduce, reuse, recycle when it comes to the waste stream. Applying that same thinking when it comes to water. How do we reduce our water use? Reduce so we get multiple benefit from our limited resources. And even recycling when and how appropriate, whether it's for industrial use, for drinking water, and everything in between, we have to maximize the limited resources that we do have. Is there a role for desalinization? Yeah, probably long term. There's different technologies that are improving upon performance, but again, they're costly, they're energy intensive, so they're not the magic wand in the near term by any stretch. It's going to be a combination of these strategies and these tools that'll help us continue to accommodate a growing population and a growing economy with decreasing water supply.
Talk to me about the money piece of that, though. I mean, do you think that the cost of whatever that portfolio of strategies is can be borne by the region alone, by ratepayers in the region alone, or is there going to have to be federal funding?
No, I think the federal funding is certainly more than appropriate here, because you look at not just the population centers in the West versus the South versus the Midwest versus the East, but look at the economic contributors that the Western United States represents. The largest contributor to the federal treasury is the state of California. And so when there's a horrific earthquake or tornado in one part of the country, we're all there to support those communities. When there's a earthquake or a wildfire in other parts of the country, we're all there to assist those communities in response. And I think the drought is no different.
I can't talk about the Colorado River without talking about the state of negotiations among the states right now over rules to govern the river after the current ones expire in 2026. To say that those negotiations are not going well, I think, would be an understatement. You know, I think there's a lot of hope among all the players that that'll turn around sometime soon. But if it doesn't turn around on its own, are you starting to think about what you could do from here and Capitol Hill to change things? California, of course, has the, you know, in terms of congressional delegations, is the 800-pound gorilla.
Well, I think there's a couple of things that we can do, quote unquote, from here, as you asked the question. And I don't assume that our first option is to introduce a piece of legislation and sort of dictate what the solutions are. Is that theoretically one of the potential routes? Maybe, but we'd also don't want to end up in courts and have judges making these determinations. I think those two threats are frankly the biggest motivator for the negotiators from each of the Colorado River states, both the upper basin and the lower basin, to realize that they have to reach some sort of a consensus. They have to reach some sort of an agreement. So whatever tension or gap between proposals there may be right now seems to be part of the process. One of the things that we will continue to do here, at least in the Senate side, I think there's a comparable process happening in the House, is we just keep convening senators from California, Arizona, Nevada, Colorado, Utah, Wyoming. We just keep coming together to try to keep conversations, if not the actual negotiations themselves, as constructive and positive as possible. Being that good influence to the negotiation process has been helpful in recent years. And frankly, I think the existence of that informal table, right? It's not a formal caucus or committee, but those semi-regular convenings is what led to line items being included in the Inflation Reduction Act that helped us address some of those short-term challenges with one-time amounts of funding, as we're able to demonstrate to our colleagues how prudent that was, how effective that was, that we got the ROI, that we got the benefit we were looking for. We set the stage for whether it's policy support going forward or funding support going forward.
You mentioned a moment ago the idea of sort of a threat, like the threat of litigation, the threat of legislation. You know, I've heard a lot of concern out of lower basin players about the sort of conversation coming out of the upper basin around potential litigation. Are you thinking about what a threat from the lower basin could look like? I mean, California is incredibly powerful in terms of congressional delegation. Is a threat called for? Or are you thinking about what that could look like?
Look, we always hope for the best, but prepare for the worst. So, you know, will litigation always be on people's minds? Of course. And so you sort of keep that in the back of your mind. But the better way to approach it is in a much more collaborative fashion, which is what has happened time and time again. And I suspect that this will be no different.
Well, Senator Padilla, thank you for joining us on the Politico Energy Podcast. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Hope to be back soon.
For more news on energy and the environment, subscribe to our free newsletter at politico.com/power-switch and subscribe to Politico Pro to read our morning energy newsletter. Some of the music in today's show was composed by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. And that's our show. I'm Annie Snyder, and we'll see you back tomorrow.
Support for this program is provided by Chevron. Chevron is taking action to keep methane in the pipe. Their 2028 upstream methane intensity target is set to be 53% below the 2016 baseline. And they're committed to evolving facility designs and operating practices. That's energy in progress. Learn more at chevron.com/methane.